another episode of We Talk Music. On the air and in your ear, and Brett, always good to catch up with an old friend, isn't it?
It is very good to catch up. I mean, it's been far too long, and you know, the interesting thing is that I was just considering giving him a call anyways, and then, what do you know, a new album comes out. We got David Rees back on the show. Cacophony of Souls is the new album, and that one's coming out in March.
March 13th, yeah. Another baby is being born. Another due date.
Well, I mean, and you're back in the studio, I understand. You're prolific.
It's part of that and some prior commitments that I've made. I'm really focusing on being a solo artist, you know, from Resilient Heart to now. And I had made commitments with a few other acts, you know, guys that had written songs that I would sing on their recordings. And tonight I'll be done. I've got two left, so.
And you sound like you're looking forward to getting done. No offense to those guys, but it sounds like you're just looking forward to moving on to your own style.
My wife works in politics at the municipality, so right now it's an election season, so she just walked in the door and, you know, we got to go to the studio, and of course she's going to be sleeping on the couch, but bless her heart, she troopers it on, you know.
Well, it's a great album. It's even harder and faster than the last one, you know. I don't know what's kind of the, you know, the genesis of the album.
After the UDO tour, I all about that, right? I released Resilient Heart November 2018, I believe. Yeah, and I did some interviews, and they said you need to call Udo's manager. That'd be perfect. The two accept singers, and I got the tour in Europe. Like, they offered me 10 days, and then it turned into 14, and then it ended up being 28 shows.
Yep.
And every night I played some of the Eat the Heat stuff, of course, and the response for that stuff and Perfect Apocalypse and some of the heavier stuff on Resilient Heart. And then I decided to watch him. You know, I'd stand on a balcony or I'd sneak around by the sound man and watch his show, like the last 30, 45 minutes of every night. And I was absorbing tempos, what worked in the audience. And I knew I had to go heavier again. And ironically, the two guitar players quit the band right after the tour. It wasn't. And then I had met Andy Susemil again in Stuttgart. And we started talking, and I went and stayed the night at his house that night, and I said, we need to do something again. And, you know, I've known him since I was doing Eat the Heat, and he was doing Mean Machine with Udo next door to each other. We've been friends for over 30 years. And the song Chasing the Shadows, the opening track, Andy and I had written and recorded that years ago. And the crazy thing was, is the label that we were on didn't put it on the CD. They put it on the running order. So Andy lost his friggin' mind. He was so angry. It's a great song.
Uh-huh.
So I had this song, Cacophony of Souls, recorded vocally. And I said, this is where we gotta go. Chasing the Shadows, this sound. And from there, it just went boom. We finished. Actually, those guys quit the band. And I had contracted like 8 festivals during the summer. So Andy joined up and we went out as a 3-piece as opposed to 2 guitar players. And it's got, Andy plays so great, he just fills the whole stage, kind of like Eddie does, or, you know, he's got that attack style guitar playing. So now we're basically a 3-piece with me as a lead singer, and Andy singing in backgrounds.
Yeah, it definitely has a more, it is definitely heavier, has that accept feel, I guess, to it, where like you say, attack, it does attack just that little bit more than Resilient Heart did.
Yeah, Resilience got kind of a bluesy feel, and that was a political push by the label, you know, if you want this deal, you got to work with this guy, and then that guy brought in this guy. I mean, we wrote some great songs together, but there's a certain thing with a guitar player and a singer, you know if it's there or not, and it just wasn't quite there. So with Andy, it's always been there, because we've done a lot of records together, we've done a lot of writing together, and we've toured a lot of shows in Europe prior to this. And we're friends, so, you know, having a friend that long, I mean, it's in this business, it says something, you know.
And you changed labels. Is that kind of part of the reason why? Just even more personal freedom?
I wasn't happy. You know, picture me. I got this great album, Brazilian Heart. And all of a sudden, I'm working it like mad. They did a few things, like, you know, contacting media. And, you know, they didn't do a terrible job, but not as good as El Puerto. And then I get the UDO tour. What kind of support can you help me with? They said, say hi to Frank Sufla, the manager, was their answer.
Wow.
I knew right now, I was standing out with my balls swinging in the wind. And I'm like, they don't care. I mean, I've given them, and we went through Scandinavia, where they're based out of. We sold out a huge place in Denmark, near Copenhagen. You know, they came to collect their merch money. And at that point, I knew that it was the wrong label. And I, you know, I'm not, if you go to the really big labels, it's kind of like, they give you like a 4-week window and they throw it on the wall and then it slides down and then they're on to another 50 bands. And, you know, they don't want to invest anything. And with El Puerto, before when I was with them, one thing I can say is they really, really get, I can talk to them and say, no, I don't like this, and then, or I like that. And they do a great job with media. And if you don't get it out there, nobody's going to hear it, mm-hmm. you know?
So, well, no,
It was a matter, I wasn't happy. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I offered them the option. I played a few songs. The only thing they asked me was, who wrote these songs with you? I mean, do you like them? It was not yes or no. You know why? Because they want the publishing money.
Yeah, right.
Fingers on the whole 50% of the publishing, because in Europe, a lot of record companies, there's an artistry division in the municipalities where if they have an entertainment thing like movies or music, they get a grant from the government on every release.
Mm.
So it's a win-win. They don't have to invest anything. They get their money back plus some, you know, but they have to have your publishing. So it was all about the greed and the monster on my back, and I said, nah, I'm out of here, you know?
Yeah, because I feel like in the last case, like with Resilient Heart, I really feel like I just went to you to connect for press. Whereas in this case, absolutely. I mean, I was prepared to go to you anyways, but I mean, I know Dustin and he does a great job with the media and of course lots of opportunities for interviews, which is, you know, always so important.
Yeah, I mean, I was asked literally for my contacts from before by the label I was on. And, you know, that's, you don't do that.
Yeah.
Because a label pays guys to reach out to you to get me the media. And they said, oh, I won't tell anybody. I said, you really think that they're not going to know that I handed over all these contacts where it came from? No. So they had this green guy in the office who didn't really have the media contacts, and I had them, but I wasn't going to sell out my friends because this is a small little world we live in, you know? That's a lot of things. So, yeah, Dustin does a great.
Yeah, and you listen, and you know, like you say, was it two albums you did with El Puerto before with Saints and Sinners?
Yeah.
So you know what you're getting into. Just got to give you some peace of mind, right?
Yeah, I knew that. I saw them at one of the Udo shows, and there was about 1,000 people that night in a fairly large club. It was packed, and I looked at the president and I said, what do you think, man? Should we get back together? Because the door's open, dude. Call me. And I said, yeah. So I had some place to go, you know. But I said, I got to play the game. I got to submit, you know, the option deal. And like I said, they just asked me who was writing the songs with me because they heard the difference, you know, the heavier sound. And I'm like, that's all you care about? I mean, see you around. Give me a yes or no, or I'm gone. And they never answered, so I moved on.
Yeah.
I was listening to, your first couple, you know, Universal Language. I was listening to that and then kind of went from that to this one. And yeah, the difference is huge style-wise. You know, and I don't know, I think both are you, but this is obviously you right now.
Yeah, I think I've hit my stride. Thank you. I you know, I loved music for so long, and then Andy produced Universal Language, and that was a compilation of a bunch of songs we threw together. I mean, some of them were really good, and I was getting my feet wet again, and then I did Compromise, you know, and he worked on that with me. You know, I'm sick of being a project boy, you know. I feel far more in control of my destiny, and I think, you know, I just said, this is the kind of album I want to make, Andy, and Andy mixed it and produced it and arranged this album. I mean, sonically, it's amazing. I mean, and you can really hear everything.
Yes.
You know, they actually put the album to, they had a clinic for Abbey Road, and Andy was invited to bring it down with a separate mastering guy who mastered this album, because typically in these guys produce, they'll master it too with the software. And the guy's name is Matt's Mix, is Matthias Fleischmann, and he's a mastering specialist. So he said, hey, they've got a clinic in Frankfurt with Abbey Road, and they've got 20,000 euro monitors. We can go play the master and see if it's correct. And they all sit around in the room and went, don't touch it. And these are cats that have worked at Abbey Road for 50 years. So I knew we had a winner there, sonically, you know. So everything about this seems to have gone right.
Yeah, and you sound better than you've ever sounded. I mean, I can really say that. I mean, you honestly, I think you're singing better than you've ever sung, you know, at this point in your life.
I'm an alcoholic, and I got sober 2 years ago. And yeah. I definitely, yeah, people have said this to me in every interview I've done. Reese, you sound like you're a kid again. You're singing better and more convincing, and I think it's an attribute. I gave up alcohol about 2 years ago. I just quit. And I think it was a benefit. I have a drinking problem. I mean, I've always had that monster on my back, and, you know, since I know you guys, we can talk, you know, straightforward, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I think also, you know, because you're even trying things with your voice in this case that I know that you hadn't really been trying in the over the last few albums.
Hmm. Like, which ones? Like, for instance?
Oh, shoot. What is it? It's
The title track, for instance. I think you got some different things going on there, you know, where it's, you know, pushing yourself.
But yeah, there's that one that... Yeah, the title track, that's the one. Yeah, where you just go really low and...
Yeah, you know, I was actually had some people reach out to Matt Bischoff at Alberto going, who did Dave hire to sing the low notes on that? Is that a... And he's like, I don't think so. And then Matt wrote me going, did you have a secret singer come in? I go, on what? It's me. But I kind of started doing that on Live Before You Die with Brazilian Heart. I was, because I'm a Bowie fan too.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a lot of interviews lately that one of the biggest annoying things I find in metal is these guys run out on stage and they make an album and then they want to do vocal gymnastics to show everybody how powerful and how high they can sing. There's no dynamic, you know? And when you age, you have to kind of learn when to deliver that little special spot. You know, and if I go back in time and I listen to like the old singers, you know, a lot of the great old singers that I admire, they didn't blow their load in the first verse. They built it. So I'm kind of working on that, you know.
How does not drinking anymore kind of help the voice then? Is it just the throat, or is it just focus, or what is it that you think is making the difference?
Everything. I was anxiety. I mean, I go in the studio and I drink a six pack to get my balls up to go in front of the mic and wail. Then on stage before I went on, I would drink. After shows, the adrenaline's pumping. I'm sitting in a hotel room in some weird country, you know, I can't sleep. So I'd go to the refrigerator and pound three or four to sleep. And I honestly thought it was, I suffer from like really bad anxiety. Like you say, you know, where do you get this motivation? I'm a really active person. I've got to stay busy to feel normal. And I would drink to take the edge off it, but since I've stopped, people like my wife have said, you're so much more focused when you speak to me. You know, you're still nuts.
We wouldn't want you any other way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad. I mean, I'm still crazy, but, you know, it was just, I was in Copenhagen, and I was working my day job, and I went to see a band play, and ran into all these Swedish guys, and those guys were wasted that night when we got there. And of course it was flowing, right? And I'm a beer drinker, I don't drink the hard stuff anymore. And I drank before I went to the party, and then I started drinking there, and I started to feel really physically bad.
Mm.
And I had been, it was just sucking the energy out of me, you know? It was really hard to just, you know, everything. Sex, attitude, And I said, it's got to be the alcohol, because every day I'd say, no, I'm not going to drink today. 3 o'clock, I'd start feeling like, you know, if I had one, I'd feel a lot better. And then the next day, it was that I'll quit tomorrow scenario. And I just got sick and tired of it. But I think it shows. I did the first real tours sober a couple of years, and I'd never done that, you know? I'd never done that, and it was easier and easier every day. My business was intact. I mean, I recommend it. I mean, because vocals, it's a muscle, and when you drink, alcohol dehydrates your vocal cords. And then you tend to push harder. And I have stage fright every night, so that was another excuse I used. Ah, a couple knocked the edge off, go out there and do it. Yeah. And I can definitely hear, you know, 10 years ago, and my voice in the studio, and then I hear these last few records, it's much better. I appreciate you saying that.
Well, that now brings up a couple of things for me, actually. I mean, you can go ahead, Mo, if you want, but...
No, go ahead.
Well, so like, yeah, I'm interested. Like, for one thing, do you find that it's hard, I guess, because rock and roll as a lifestyle is very alcoholic, very drug-induced in a lot of cases. Do you find it hard being on the road and having other people drink around you, or is that something that you've kind of phased out?
Choice, and I mean, I'm not gonna lie, there's been a couple of times where I've sat around like at restaurants and said, it's when I was in Bulgaria a few months ago, they were all drinking my favorite beer, and I looked at it and said, man, that looks delicious. And then I went, nah, not today. And but on tour, no, it was like I kind of had this thing too, and I'm not gonna lie, you know, because everybody said I, you know, slap Peter and they accept A's, and yeah, I was drinking then, and I wanted to show them that, you know, I was still viable and I could kick ass and I don't need it. And Udo doesn't party on stage. You got a job to do.
Yep.
You know, we had a great Australian band play in front of us called Dead City Ruins. And I recommend them highly, actually. They'd come in my dressing room and I always had two cases of beer provided by the promoter. And they go, Mike, the beer ready? I said, pick it up, boys. Right on, Mike. See you tomorrow. And they'd carry out all the cases. They had theirs. And they'd 25-year-old guys, you know, having a great time touring Europe from Australia. So, it was never, it's not. I don't drink in the studio. So, you know, in the studio, it's really easy because you relax, it's dark, you know, crack a few, you know, start work all night, you know. But no, it's actually a real joy to wake up and feel clean and listen back to myself and go, not bad.
Yeah, and it must be nice to be able to see the results of it for sure. But
Glenn Hughes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he would allow. I mean, he's singing better than he ever has. I mean, the guy quit 20 something years ago, and I mean, I think it actually saved him because he was always brilliant. But I mean, his voice is the same as
yes.
It was in Come Taste the Band. It's crazy.
Yeah, he's amazing. Now, the other question I wanted to ask was about the stage fright. Like, so how many songs into a show would you say does it take you to kind of get over the feeling?
The first one, you can feel it. I mean, there were some people doing this, actually, like a knife across the throat in some German shows, the anti-Dave guy, the haters.
Oh, yeah.
Mix up. I mean, and if you look in their eyes, you just smile. You know they hate you, they're not going to move because it's so crowded. You know, that first 45 seconds, you know, you kind of got to, like, I don't know, harness the tiger and pace yourself from that moment, and then it goes. And then you forget everything. You know, it's one of the only times in my day with my crazy brain where I don't think about anything else but music and singing songs. And it's a wonderful kind of drug, so to speak. It's natural. And then it's over, you know. And the wind down time is a bitch. I mean, you don't even realize the adrenaline. I think Bon Jovi said it. He goes, I just played in front of 20,000 people and a car drove me to this hotel and I'm sitting in this quiet room with my ears ringing. What am I going to do? You know, what do I do now? Usually right before I go on, I'm really, really nervous. And then right when it kicks in and the people are kind of doing the armchair, show me something thing, you know, it's salesmanship. And you just do the best you can. And you can feel when the band's not firing on all cylinders, so it's your job to step up the game too. We did a gig in Oslo on a cruise ship and everybody was nervous and the boat was really moving because it was really rough seas. And the band were like, wow, you know, this is weird. And you know, I could feel the band were thinking while they were playing. And halfway through it, we pulled out of it. But that was a tough one. But the audience went crazy. So.
Yeah, I guess it must help a lot to have the right audience in the right situation, for sure. Because, you know, and I know we've talked to so many musicians, right? And it's like getting the right crowd. I mean, we just talked to Steve Gorman, who was the drummer for the Black Crowes, and you know, he'd talk about the shows and just how the band would react to the crowd, and just how you could tell when the band is a cohesive unit playing on stage, for sure.
I've seen them when they were just unbelievable. I saw they played 5 nights at the Greek in LA, and they came out, and that singer was all over the place. The audience was dancing and really. And then I saw them like the third show, and it was like somebody must have got into a fist fight because they're not even looking at each other. It's like they're just standing there, and you could really feel like there wasn't a band. I know exactly about the Black Crowes; they're notorious for that. And I think it's kind of sad that he's not in the band because he was great.
Yeah,
I thought he was a slamming drummer.
No, you know, of course, what do you know? Like, it's the music industry, right? So, I mean, like, and yeah, like the brotherhoods and fighting and stuff like that. And I think that's the nice thing about you talking about wanting to do your own thing, and just kind of shift over to that, because you're eliminating the need to fight with somebody else, and you're taking control, and it's just like you don't have to worry about those kind of elements.
I've been promoting this heavily, this album. I've realized in the last 3 or 4 years there is nothing, there's no democracy in a rock and roll band. It's either one or two guys kind of, you know, flying the enterprise, you know what I mean? And Andy and I are kind of doing that. I'm the boss, he's the vice president, then we got the great rhythm section, but you can't, I've got this fantasy all my life of the brotherhood, we all get along like a family, go hang out together. It just doesn't work that way. And the older you get, the more personal lives you have, the wives you have, the kids, the divorces, the lawsuits, all that, you know, your normal job. You know, you've got to, it's like, I always say it's like juggling alley cats, you know, trying not to get your arm shredded. You know what I mean? And now a lot of bands are playing in multiple bands, so scheduling tours is always a nightmare. And of course, I want to be the main focus, and they're like, yeah, but I got to get paid on this, and I already promised for that. So it's a whole different dynamic there, too. So I'm in charge of it. So what I did, being a solo artist, if you're not available, I'll hire this cat to do the show. I used to wait and say, okay, you have some gigs, I'll just rebook. But once you say no to a date, you lose the date.
Yeah.
So I'm of the mindset, this is David Reese, and it's not arrogance, I just have to play. And the band knows that. You know?
Now then, I get, well, and that's, oh,
actually, I'm just thinking, you know, back to, you know, in your relationships in the past bands and these, you know, difficulties that you've had. I'm guessing the alcohol actually wouldn't have helped with that either.
Oh, hell no. That's one reason I quit. Most of the trouble I've been in is alcohol related. I'm not going to lie. I can go back over my life and say, you know, I got arrested driving. Why? I was drunk. I Peter Baltus because I drank a fifth of Jack Daniels before I went on stage. I mean, had I not been drinking, maybe it wouldn't have been so intense. But at the time, I didn't know how to deal with the non-communication and everybody fighting, and you know, it was just my way of venting. But there was always alcohol involved, you know. So it's not just, you know, the singing thing about it. It's the Dave thing. You know, I'm still fucking nuts, but I thought that alcohol was controlling my anxiety because a lot of it has to do with that. You know, you want to be successful. You want to have a successful album. It's really tough now. I mean, it's tougher now than it was 30 years ago. And you just sit down and get into a rut, and you become explosive. I wasn't violent all the time. I was just loud, you know, abrasive. I'm a dentist. I thought my shit didn't stink, and you know that's not how it works.
You know, I really appreciate you talking about things, because I also have anxiety, and I think it's an issue that still needs to be talked about more. You know, it's the type of thing that your willingness to talk about and your experiences with it is, it's all part of getting it out there and helping people understand it. And yeah. I think the idea that somebody like yourself, who's so talented and has been doing this for so long, would still get nervous before playing is, I think that's in some ways it's almost comforting to other people who have it. Okay, that means anybody can have it, and anybody can overcome it.
Yeah, I mean, Steven Tyler said something to me one night years ago. I was standing in a dressing room before a gig, and he ran into the dressing room, and I'd never met him, and he was talking to my friend and wondering what set list to do. The new shit or the old shit? And then listen to him, his speaking voice is like this. You know, yeah, he talks like that when he goes out there and screams his head off. And he said, "Oh, man." So they made a set list, and he looked at me and said, "Ah, you got the butterflies, huh?" And I went, "Yeah, I'm scared shitless." And he said, "Good, me too. Used it." And he walked out of the room, and I went, it just kind of calmed me down. I go, "You get it?" And he goes, "Fuck yeah, man. Fucking normal. What's wrong with you?" You know, and then he just left the room, and I went, "Wow." Because I've got some guys I play with that absolutely no anxiety. They go in and plug in and just rock. They don't even think about it. But me, my daughter and I just talked today. She suffers from it. You know, and she's actually sober now too. And giving that a whack to see if that helps. And she said she's feeling better. But I mean, you guys are the same. You know, there's two kinds of musicians. There's listeners and players, right? So we all suffer in our own little Idaho somehow, and how we cope, you know, day to day. And that wasn't working.
Yeah.
I got a new job. I've been employed by the Sober Society. Thank God. And the funny thing is, I could be shit-faced drunk right now, and you guys wouldn't know it. Because we've done interviews, and I've had a bottle of beer over here, and I'm drinking, and I'm getting away from the camera, and I'm drinking the whole time 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I'm shit-faced.
Yep.
It's functioning.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's part of the whole concept of functioning alcoholic, right? Is that you just get so used to you know, imbibing that you know, and that's the thing, right? Like it's not like two or three drinks. It does become the six drinks. It does become the eight drinks.
And it starts, you know, I don't drink before 5. Then it starts at, you know, 2, and then it's noon, then it's 9 in the morning. And then you think it's normal. And it's not.
Mm-hmm.
I did an album in Sweden with a friend of mine in like 2010. And I remember we go to these Swedish liquor stores on Friday. They're government controlled. And the places are packed, man. It's like going to Target for alcohol, right? And we've got 2 shopping carts for the weekend of the most heavy Carlsberg. I mean, and we're recording. And we could just open the studio door and put all the cans in the snow. Ice cold. And our rational one. We'll take the 7.5% alcohol and mix it with the 3.2. That way, it's not wrong. But then we end up drinking 15 more than normal. And we'd get up in the morning and we'd have a garbage sack, and his wife would look at us and go, "Oh my God." You know, we did that for 3 straight months, but it was normal.
Yeah. But what about the songs on the album then? Is any of that represent the new sobriety? Is any of that in the lyrics and the what you're saying? Because there's a lot. You're saying a lot of these songs.
Yeah.
A lot. We talked about this before. You know, I'm not the whoa, 80s pop singer guy.
Nope.
Never was. I'm not built for it. I'm a big man. I don't have the little skinny body, you know, the big blonde makeup hair. I like lyrics that have something to say. Chasing the Shadows might be a bit about anxiety, nightmares. Cacophony of Souls is I've realized we have a rule in my house where there's no iPhones at the dinner table. When my wife and I talk, we turn off our phone and we look at each other. We turn off the TV. Everybody just seems kind of like in a cacophony of a noise where they're not really communicating. And the guy said something to me really funny the other day. He said, life seems to be going by faster. I think it's because I'm on the internet too much. It was just Monday yesterday, and now it's Friday. And I thought about that. And I went, you know what? Everything is just information. Blood in our hands is, there's not anybody that I know, at least me personally, that I know that hasn't got some garbage in their closet. And I'm watching the Syrian conflict. I'm watching this political thing go on. That is what that's all about. Europe is, God knows what's happening over here right now. Immigration, the politics, everybody in America is split down the middle. And it's the same in Italy. It's the same in Germany. There is no moderate middle anymore.
Yeah.
That affects me. A lot of times I'll come up with an idea if somebody says something like the ballot, another life, another time. My wife used to go to a lot of my big shows. And like I said earlier, I did an album in Bulgaria. John Steele, Blaze Bailey had done an album with them and Doogie White. Well, Doogie went on to Shanker. And they said, can you do some shows? Well, it evolved into me being asked to do their new album. Well, we were doing some festivals over there. And I said, let's go to Bulgaria. You've never been there. She goes, yeah. And typically, we fly sitting next to each other. But this flight, there was a man in between us. And she was leaning over, and I was leaning over at the airplane noise and, you know, trying to be somewhat civilized and talk. She just went like this, another life, another time. And I went, oh, I grabbed the pen and started scribbling on the, Ryanair paperwork. I wrote the lyrics down and I sent it to Andy. And I mean, within a half an hour, I mean, that same night, I think, he sent me that melody and that layout. I have to say, Andy Susamil is one of the most underrated guitarists that I've ever known. He produced, mixed, and arranged this album. And his background vocals. He's actually a solo artist himself. He sings lead vocal. Him and I I don't know what it is, and I don't want to figure it out. There's something we can do together musically. If I've got an idea and he does, it just goes pop. And I think we hit it. We hit a lick on this record. I really do. The reviews have been in the high 90s. And one guy said to me yesterday, I'd have given you 100, but if I do, my boss will get mad at me. So that's 100. I've never had that. I'm usually in the 7.5, genre, maybe an 8 point out of 10. But they're throwing them at me, and everybody's like, Reese, this is the album. This is your album.
And I love that Metal Voice is the single that you've released, because it's one of my favorite tracks.
Yep.
And I think it just really captures the album really well.
Jimmy K's show. Honestly, that was not a political guided. And that was Andy's idea, because we were, the Udo thing, hey, and all that, hey, and the metal festival. And I threw in the hey part, and he just came up with, raise your metal voice, and I went, hey. So we filmed all the shows that we did together. Have you seen the video?
Yeah.
So that's taken from Denmark, from Italy, and from the last summer shows, and Run Bashy, the guy who did my artwork and does my videos, he put that together for me. And it's really being well received. The song just kind of hit a chord with people. It's, actually going back to that Udo tour, Firepower, I was listening to in the van after shows or before. And I really got it because marketing-wise, if you looked at the artwork, it kind of had the Screaming for Vengeance look. And Priest went back to Priest. And I listened to it every day. You know what I mean? And I was sucking it all in, absorbing. And then you play with a guy like Udo, Funny story about Udo, the first night of the tour. Udo doesn't warm up, all right? He's a German panzer. German panzer. I mean, the guy plays Candy Crush in the dressing room. It's time.
Okay, let's do it.
The guy's sitting there with his big jacket on playing Candy Crush. I mean, in another world, and it's like, it's time, and the intro tape's going, and okay. And at the time, he had this really bad bone infection in his leg, and he's walking around in a cane, and they said, you need to cancel the tour. This could be bad. I never canceled. And it was bad, and he never took drugs, so they got him doped up on pain pills, because it was agonizing. I mean, anyways, the first night of the tour, I was excited to see him again, because last time I'd seen him was like 2007 at Sweden Rock, and he comes walking down the dirt road backstage, and we hugged, and of course the paparazzi, oh, it's the Dukes up, guys. And so anyways, I look over in the stall, and I'm going, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I see these 2 feet, somebody sitting on the throne, and I hear, shut the fuck up, Reese. I said, I have to do this, Udo. He goes, no, you don't. It's rock and roll. Just go fucking sing. Shut up. So he comes out of the stall, you know, and the smell is horrible, you know. I was like, oh, God, we're in there gagging. And he's like hugging me. And I'm like, sorry to interrupt your wonderful moment, but I got nowhere to warm up in front of you. He goes, ah, fuck that. Let's rock. And he hugged me. And it was like I just saw him the day before. And every night he would say to me after the gig, you're doing ecstasy wrong. I said, no, I'm not. It's my fucking song. He said, you're doing it wrong. One night I shall show you. I said, okay, challenge accepted, dude. Come on stage. What night? You will know. I will have a microphone. Okay. Well, every night the band's like, maybe tonight he's going to walk. Leg. But we got towards the end of the tour in Sweden, and his son Sven, who's playing drums with him, of course, said, Dad's not going to make it. You know, his leg is up. He goes, but I want to play drums on Ecstasy. I said, come on. And he walked out on stage and went, bah! And the crowd went nuts, and he fucking slammed it. But that's how I got back to see Udo again the first time. He was taking a dump, and I was in the bathroom. Human, right? I mean, when I see these shoes, I don't know who it is. Then I hear that, shut the fuck up. But, and here's another one, Udo. We're in Hamburg, and I'm watching every gig, but that night, I didn't watch the opening song, because this old theater was really, the walls were black. I mean, you couldn't even see where you were going. Ancient place. I don't know how the bombs didn't level it in the war, but I played there before. I can't remember the name of the place. And Udo's on the cane, and my dressing room is upstairs on the balcony, and they go on, and I can hear him in the dressing room, and he's wailing away. After the gig, he walks in, he goes, did you see what happened? I said, no. And he goes, I was walking up the stairs, and I used the bad leg, and the top stair was higher, and I caught it with my foot, and I landed right on my nose. Oof. I said, and he said, yeah, I landed right on my face, and I just stood up and went out and sang. I went, wow. And that's what he's like. He's bulletproof. I mean, if you got the flu, he's whatever. He just goes out and he's Udo, you know?
Yeah,
I know. It's funny. Yeah, we've heard those stories before about him, and it is amazing to think about the career, because he's been Udo for so long, and I know that he's Udo, but like the whole singing style and everything, like, you just think to yourself, how do you manage to pull that off successfully? You know, and we've seen him live, and it's all the same shit. Like, it's just like, bam.
7 days a week, you know, and he's a robot. I mean, he's grown up on the road. I mean, he formed Accept, I think, in 1975. I mean, originally, it was him and Michael Wagner, the producer, playing guitar. I mean, and the thing about it is, after shows, I'd be standing at the merch booth, and everybody would say, we're Udo fans, and you can really feel it. They've got his face tattooed on their chest,
yeah,
or on their neck, and they've been following him. And you know, you got people from 14 years old to 70 years old that are Udo fans. You know, multiple shows, you'll see the same people at 5 shows. They'll just take their vacation and follow Udo. And I mean, he's got a loyal legion of fans, and he can do 2 things. He can do Udo, or he can do Dirk Schneider. Well, he'll do the metal hard thing this year.
Yeah.
And Baltus, back, he's going to play with Udo. And Stefan Kaufman will be playing guitar in that band. So three of the original guys are going to do the metal hard anniversary tour, some festivals. So the Accept buzz right now in Europe is really strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
X members.
Yeah.
Now, he's the ultimate no bullshit singer.
Yeah.
No bullshit.
No bullshit.
He knows his limits. He knows he's not Bon Jovi. He's Udo.
Yeah.
And then the career out of, you know, what he does. You know, one thing I was told by Gabby, the manager, And I said, what is it about him, you know? Because, you know, we were struggling with the new singer, me. And he said, you know why it works for Udall? And I said, why? He goes, because he's one of them. He's one of them. And he's an average fuel yep. factory working
guy. Yeah.
And, you know, he doesn't give a shit about looking like Schwarzenegger. He's a fucking metalhead. He's one of them. And it was true. True words. I tip my hat to him.
Now, one thing I'm interested in, like, as we talk about Udo and just the fact that he's, you know, indestructible in that regard, but, like, there's other singers that are also, like, really able to kind of just get out there, nail it right off the bat. Now, did you ever look at those guys and try to see, like if you can or can't be like them? And if so, like, if you can't do that, like, I mean, you can't be like Udo, and I mean, not necessarily sure you want to in that regard, but like, did it ever bother you at any point, or was it always kind of like, I need to be myself?
Why, that I wasn't as successful that?
No, but just yeah. be able to go without warming up and just immediately sing.
I've had to. When you're touring a lot of dates, the first few days you're checking out what you got from the night before because you're not sleeping. I mean, we traveled I had a song that I wrote. It was married man who rides around in a minivan. I mean, that would watch him drive all night long. You know, I mean, we were just six of us in a freaking minivan with gear, and you're not going to sleep real good. And singers, you know, you got to stretch out because the trapezoids and the back muscles and everything are all connected to that muscle, and drummers. So you do your tests, you know, before you go on, but you kind of get into this mechanic part of it, machinery. It's a machine. And like the third or fourth day, you know where you are. You can hear it when you speak. So you're less concerned about warming up. Plus, there's that time schedule. One thing you have to do on tour is you'll drive 5 or 6 hours, and you perform, 45 minutes on that tour, an hour? But then you've got 23 hours to do nothing. You really need to control your energy, because you got to give everything you've got when you walk out, like you said earlier, that stage fright and stuff. You got to harness that racehorse. You know, Secretariat's in the stall, and he's about to come flying out, and he's going to ring the bell and go. Some days you feel better than others. You have those long conversations about politics, and you learn a lot about people when you're riding in a van and everybody's tired and missing their families. So that, you know, that wears on you too. But I've always looked at guys like Bruce Dickinson. He beat cancer. I saw Iron Maiden on this tour. Blew my mind. Of course, he's not singing way up here like he used to. In little places he does. And Halford, he's backed off a bit, but they still have it. You know, when they're gone, I don't know what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, I don't even think about that. But I do want to talk about the album cover to Cacophony of Souls, because I think it's really cool, and it's got a little bit of a tie-in to Resilient Heart. So what was kind of your concept behind it?
That was Randeshi, the guy that did Metal Voice, the video. He does a lot of my artwork. He had done a painting, that cover, and we were in Switzerland. And I had come up with this, like, military guy pushing a button, blowing up the universe, that was the chief from Resilient Heart. And the band looked at the rough sketch and said, that looks stupid. What are you doing? I said, oh, it's going to be great when it's done. It just erupts that. And then nobody was buying it. And the drummer, Andrea Giannangeli, was in the back seat of our car. My wife and I were driving to a gig from here. It's about 2 hours to Switzerland. So he pulled out this little hand flyer for the show that Randashi had made. He goes, what about this? And it popped, you know, the orangish red. And he goes, if you put that chief in the background, maybe put a metal horns guy. If you look at it closely, there's a hand coming out of the audience.
Oh, yeah, I see that.
And a lot of people say they look at the album cover and then they'll look at it again and go, oh, I didn't see that. So that's how that was born. And my manager saw it. He goes, bingo, it pops. Let's use it. So that's become, and I've kept the David Reese now thing because, believe it or not, there's a band called Reese from Wales. My name is actually Welsh. My father's adopted, so his father must have been Welsh. It's like Johnson in Wales. And there's everybody, hi, I'm John Reese. I'm David Reese. I'm Ralph Reese. I'm like, how do you spell it? Your way. Well, then I found out there was a band called Reese and his three brothers. So I did the reverse E, and it was a conflict with promoters because I go, wait a minute, I just booked Reese last week. Why do you want to come back? No, this is David Reese. What? Well, my manager said, we got to put David Reese on there. We got to fix this.
Mm.
That's what it is from now on. But I included the brand. The Chief has kind of worked well for me.
It's great. I mean, it's one of my favorite logos ever, I think, is the Chief, for sure.
Yeah, it looks so good. And, you know, there's a rapper also in America named Reese. So you got to...
Really?
Yeah, when you go in, sometimes you look for your discography and they get mixed in, and it's and he's got like 47 albums for some reason. So
all the same, right?
Yeah.
Well, so with rappers, you know, they do a lot of mixtapes, so it's easy to get like 47 albums.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the fact that you go into David Reese is good, just from that perspective. But a couple of my favorite tracks, just want to. Get your probably maybe my favorite might be Judgment Day. I don't think you talked about that one yet. I love that track.
Wow, I mean, I they're calling that one every interview. that's my Holy Diver on the album. I mean, I said we need a Holy Diver, and he goes, yeah. And then he came up with that, and then I came up with the lyric, and it's about Judgment Day. We're all gonna have to answer for what we've done. And I'm actually going to shoot a video for it, and I'm going to dress like the Pope.
Oh,
nice!
I'm going to have nuns. I found on Amazon the uniform, man. But I was thinking, well, I'll go into a church in Italy, some nice old ancient place. I go, but if I dress like the Pope, I could be killed. Well, I've got to create a, you know, I got to be really careful because he's kind of the boss of Italy right now, you know, or has been forever. So you got everything kind of goes around what Papa says, so. I want to dress like the Pope and do kind of an Aussie freaky face at the podium, and I'm going to have nuns, models, dressed like nuns, and maybe I'll have them stripped down and do something crazy. But that song, it's amazing because I just did an interview 30 minutes before I talked to you, and the guy said that the part that really strikes him is the power of the vocal, but that middle break where Andy plays the nylon string solo.
Oh, yeah.
The atmosphere.
Yeah. That's the part that makes it soar.
Yeah,
that goes to another level there.
It needs a video. It needs to really be exposed. It's you know, and that song when I recorded it, I was like, yeah, it's kind of corny, you know. And then I thought, ah, fuck it, man, be angry, sing it angry, and really give it, you know. And I didn't really know what Andy was going to do sonically on that or musically, so that part wasn't there. He composed that, and that's another thing back to Andy Susamil. I mean. He can play Strangers in the Night front to back to front as a 14-year-old kid. Gary Moore, all those guys he grew up listening to, but he somehow has developed this, he called him Super Meal. He's got his own style too. And from the albums that we did 10 years ago to now, he has grown. I don't know how to explain it. He's a super gifted guy. And if anybody's really gifted, I'm going to give him kudos. And I'm blessed to have him in my camp. You know?
Another one of my favorite tracks is, and I really love also the placement of it because it's kind of closest, like, probably the closest thing to an AOR song on the album. And it's the second to last song, so it kind of brings things down. And, you know, you're up, comes down, and then goes back up on No Disguise. But Bleed, I love Bleed. I think that's a real good track.
We play that live. That to me is just, that's the epitome of, you know, modern metal and 80s metal combined.
Yeah.
Got the cool Bangalore kind of middle bridge melodic thing. That's one of my favorites too.
Yeah, it's a real good track. And right before that is A Perfect World. So, and those two, I just think that they fit together well, so well. A Perfect World's just, it's just, I mean, it's a really terrific album. I mean, these are probably my highlight tracks, you know, Judgment Day, Another Life, Another Time, Cacophony of Souls, A Perfect World, and Bleed. Those are for me, those would be my five standout tracks for me.
Thank you. I agree. And it's funny you say that. Those are the ones that people mention.
Oh, and Metal Voice, of course. Metal Voice. Cannot mention that. I love that.
We were lucky enough to have, I had recorded demos for Metal Voice and Blood in Our Hands. And those last stage shows we did with Andy, we played it live. And every night people would come up and go, that the new stuff? Yep. They go, fuck, can't wait to hear the album. That's where it's going. We're on the right page. And I listened to the bands on the UDO tour. I mean, every night people had EP, and they had Perfect Apocalypse and those songs. They say, Dave, this is who you are. And, you know, you got to listen to that. You know,
yeah.
And then we're, you know, God, I hated you, you know, but this album, Eat the Heat, now is one of my favorites. I'm standing there, and verbatim, I could repeat what they're going to say. But if you think about an album that's lasted 30-plus years, and they reissued it during that tour on a special gold vinyl, or orange vinyl, 2,000 copies, so the timing just all kind of fell together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm playing it live. And they sold them in like a week. They were gone. So a lot of guys were bringing that orange vinyl and had opened it up and had me sign the vinyl. I was like, it's sacred. Don't sign it. No, it's my collection. But I had found Eat the Heat cassettes from 1989. I have a collector friend in the cellophane. I brought those to merch. They were gone in 2 days. I had like,
oh, yeah.
Wow. Gone. I mean, so, you know, it all just, yeah, I mean, I you got to listen to your fans, you know, and you know when a song is good. And I can see it in your eyes when you point on the song. That song really got me in it. And I hear it day after day after day. The same songs you mentioned.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
it's
cool.
It's interesting. For me, like definitely the ballad, you know, Another Life. Like that one, I actually found myself singing along because I told you yesterday that I was cranking the album, and I found myself, even though I'd only heard it the second time, I was already singing along to it myself. So that was good. And also I love Back in the Days as well, just lyrically.
Really?
It's one of those ones that speaks to me lyrically.
Yeah,
me too. I wrote that with Martin Frank, and that's kind of got the Bangalore Choir on target thing. Like Perfect World has a little bit of Bangalore Choir in there. My, you know, right after Accept, I put that band together. And some of that came out of me. And back in the days, it seems that the Canadians and the North Americans like that song, but the Europeans never bring up Back in the Days. So it's definitely geared for where we come from, you know, the story. And the band's not even that fond of it, but I love it.
That's what it's trying to.
Yeah, I
honestly
love the song, but you know, Andy's kind of
like, eh. But yeah, that's interesting though, because it makes sense, right? Because I mean, you know, Bangalore Choir is really where I know that we got onto you, and so I think that you know, hearing something that does kind of harken back to that for me, especially. I mean, it's one of those like, oh yeah, oh man.
Back in the days.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm every day getting ready for the show, so it's, you know, it's kind of nice. You know, I'm doing these songs for this German guy, and then after that, I run through my songs and my set, kind of just remind myself of the fucking words because I can't remember them. Terrible, man. I mean, I can't remember shit, and then I walk on stage and it all clicks. I mean, I'll look at a guy and go, what are the words for that song? And the guy will look at me in the band and go, what? You wrote it? And I'm like, I can't remember how it goes. And as soon as the band starts, it comes. It's weird mental block shit that I have.
So
I think Brett had said to you, we wanted some stories, right, Brett?
Yeah, that's right. We always
didn't you say we got the Udo stories, but we know you got to have, I mean, so many stories over the years. Didn't Brett tell you to prepare for you?
Have you ever told you any Chris Holmes stories?
No, I don't think we got any Chris Holmes stories.
No, we need a Chris Holmes story.
You're smiling already, and so are we. Just the concept.
I went to do a KISS convention last May in Helsinki. I was invited to sing, and we were talking about Wasp, you know. And then this guy says, "You toured with Wasp, right? With Accept?" And I go, "Yeah, I know Chris really well, and it's a Russian guy living in Helsinki." And he's telling me this story that every day on his bicycle, he's going to work, and he looks across this little river, and there's this crazy caveman-looking guy covered in tattoos, washing his clothes, and drinking the fucking same river. And he goes, that guy looks like Chris Holmes. And he's like, what the fuck would Chris Holmes be in Helsinki for? And I mean, it's like getting...
And he lives there.
And one day, it just... Yeah, I couldn't take it. He goes, so I cross the bridge, and I go over, and he's sitting out in the yard drinking a beer, smoking a cigarette, and he goes, are you Chris Holmes? He goes, yeah. He goes, where do you live? He goes, I'm living in this abandoned schoolhouse. He goes, yeah, I don't have any place to stay. Why are you in Helsinki? Well, I heard there's some cool rock and roll bands up here, and I came up here looking for a band. And he's like, what? And he's like, yeah, you know anybody looking for a guitar player? And he's like, yeah, I kind of am. And he goes, cool, let's jam. And so he said, well, come over to my house and, you know, have a meal and we'll talk. And he said he didn't leave for like a year and a half. Slept on his couch. He said, I couldn't get rid of the guy. He goes, we never did anything. He never rehearsed. He drank beer all day. Now he's sober. But that was one of my Chris Holmes stories. And another one that I always loved was that there were some Iron Maiden guys were telling me they had gone to this big dinner in Manhattan, and everybody's avoiding Chris. But the thing about Chris Holmes is he's a big teddy bear. He looks frightening, but he's a sweetheart. And I knew him after the Wasp tour. I'd go over when he was married to Lita, and I'd be in his house, you know, and be doing nefarious things. And, you know, the old voice box would come on when she would call from tour, right? Chris, pick up the phone. And he'd be like, shh, I wish you can't hear you, Chris. And he's like, shh. And she goes, Dave, are you in my house? And I'd be like, you guys better not be doing bad stuff. And we'd be like, we'd go over to hang out with Chris. But anyways, the story I thought was pretty funny was I was told that Chris was covered in all the makeup and his garb, you know, after a gig the next day, hadn't bathed. We were in this Ritchie restaurant, and the Iron Maiden guys were there, and they heard somebody screaming, nobody loves me. Nobody loves me. And he had cut his wrist with a whiskey glass and was standing on a table bleeding. Nobody loves me. And people were running for their lives in New York, right? All the family, the Iron Maiden guys were like, oh, time to go, Chris is drunk, you know? Anyways, that's why, and I heard the Helsinki story after I'd seen Chris a few years ago. My wife's a big Wasp fan, and Chris was playing here in my village, of all places. Like, let's go see Mean Man, name of his band. I go to the door, and I say, tell Holmes, Reese is here. And 5 minutes later, the guy's going, come in, sir, blah, blah, blah. And I go into the dressing room, and he's there with Kathy, his wife, and he's got this giant pizza sitting at the table. And he's looking at me, and he goes, what the fuck are you doing in Italy? I said, I live here. And I go, I live here. He goes, what? He goes, no way. I go, yeah. And he goes, you know what? I've been sober for 19 years. And I said, great, man. That's really great. He goes, you know why? Because every time I got drunk, I did something fucking stupid. I go, yeah, I know the stories. You and I hung out together. And he had this big pizza. And he asked my wife, would you like some? And she's like, oh, no, thank you. You did? Nope. And he folded it in half and ate the whole thing. He devoured it. And then he went on stage and he was wearing pants that said, go fuck yourself on both sides. And he had the dark body guitar and he'd flip it up, go fuck yourself. The crowd went crazy. I mean, he had a great little band. But that's Chris, man. I mean, I always felt something for him. You know what I mean? I know he was treated badly in Wasp, but Chris is generally, he's rock and roll. I mean, doing that Decline of Western Civilization, shit-faced in the pool with his mom, that really didn't make Blackie happy.
No.
That was bad. It's still infamous all these years later, right? It's still one of the most, if you look at it, the views it has on YouTube every year just go up exponentially. It's just gonna last forever, unfortunately.
He's rock and roll, man. I mean,
it's rock and roll.
Helsinki. A Russian guy. I'm thinking, he looks so much like Chris Holmes. I must stop and talk to him. He goes, I'd be in my office thinking, I know it's Chris Holmes. I'm a fan. It's got to be him. Why is he in Helsinki? I mean, and he's living in an abandoned schoolhouse with no electricity. He's homeless.
That's... Oh, yeah, because...
Yeah, that's one of my stories, Chris.
Because I've looked into to getting Chris on the show, you know, because this is like, oh man, because we love Chris Holmes too, and I had seen like he lives in Helsinki, and at the time like we hadn't done a lot of interviews with people, you know, from other regions, and so it was just like, oh, how are we gonna pull this off? And now it's just like,
he would need electricity to start with.
There's that, yeah.
Yeah.
He lives in France now, I believe. With his wife, I mean, he lives in France. He's doing really well. He's been clean, got his health 24 years. I mean, one time he was telling me a story about a festival in Scandinavia, and he looked at me all serious, and we're out of our minds. He goes, we were playing in Scandinavia in the summertime. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and you know the sun was still out. I go, yeah, that's called the summer solstice. He goes, that's fucked up, man. He goes, I'm comes out, and there was like 100,000 people, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And he goes, at that time, Blackie and I, we'd all done the raw meat photo, right, for Wasp. And he goes, everybody that would come to gigs would throw raw meat at the stage. And he was going, yeah, they were throwing fucking cow eyes and cow tongues and cow's heads and shit like that on stage while we're playing. It got crazy. And he goes, I'm playing away, right? And it's three. He kept telling me, and the sun's out, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And it fascinated him. And he goes, I look out into the crowd, and I see this thing flying at me. And it hits me right in the forehead. It's a frozen roast. And he said, it knocks me out cold. And he goes, it hits me full force, knocks me out on the stage. And he goes, you know, I like my Budweiser beer, right? I got a Budweiser guitar. And he likes to explain it. I go, yeah, Chris, I know you're a Budweiser guy. Well, every night I got a case, you know, 48 cans right here next to me because I like Budweiser. You know, I like Budweiser. Well, anyways, I'm knocked out cold, and he's telling me this, and I'm trying not to laugh in hysterics because I can picture it. The band's playing. He's laying there, and his guitar tech freaks out and opens the big plastic box of beer, and he goes, I just started to wake up, and he dumped all those beers on my head and knocked me out again. It was fucked up, man. It was a frozen rose. Bow! Right in the head. Anyways, if you get a chance to talk to Chris, give him a shout. He's tell him I love him, and I said hi. But guys, I gotta get out of here. I gotta be in the studio in 30 minutes.
All right.
Absolutely, David. Thanks.
Totally appreciate talking to you.
Yeah.
I love you.
Plug it. Time to plug it. Plug it. Everything you got.
Great. David Reese, Cacophony of Souls, released on El Puerto Records March 13th. That's our beginning of our touring. Go to David Reese Official on Facebook. You can find all the tour dates. Europe, UK, Europe, some festivals in the summer. And then again in the fall, you can pre-order right now, and there's a special limited metal box with some goodies inside that El Puerto is offering, and they're about gone. Reviews have been great. I want to thank all of you there at the podcast, and I want to thank all the fans, and hello to Canada. I love you, and I'm trying to get to Canada. Actually, I'm talking to some promoters to get over there and play, because I've been back and forth on Highway 1. Multiple times, so I know Frankie and Johnny's. I played there a million times in Calgary. I know Edmonton. I mean, I've been all over that place. So, God willing, I can get back to Canada and rock with you guys. Thank you very much.
That'd be amazing. Thank you.